Call the meeting to order at 3:01. We got four of us, and so we'll go ahead and log in. With us right now is Representative Miller, Representative Seaton, and we have a new member, Representative Beth Kertula. Representative Sisna has stepped down, time management, energy management type stuff. She assured me she still loves us and is going to miss us, and she served in this committee for 11 years, and so she'll be missed. But anyway, welcome.
Thank you. It's my first time to serve on the HES committee, so it's kind of exciting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. It's March 10th, like I say, it's about 3:02. We have three things on the agenda today. One of them is we're going to start with HCR1, and part of the reason there is Representative Steve Thompson is a co-sponsor on this. It's Representative Peterson's bill.
And Representative Peterson going to be here?
Well, the last we heard.
Okay. I said 60 seconds.
Oh, you'd be here. That's all right. That's fine. It'll take me 60 seconds at least to finish up the opening here that I got going. But anyway, we'll do that first because Representative Thompson has a something else going at 3:30. Representative Herron has joined us. And then after that, we'll go to HCR3. Representative Munoz has a bill on elder Alaskans. And then lastly today, we'll have HCR5. On HCR5, I don't intend to pass that out today. We got a, what was it, what did they call it, a virtual fiscal note or a hypothetical fiscal note. And I think we'll spend a little time discussing it and going over it, but that's the intent. On the other two, I don't have any preconceived plan. It depends on what the committee wishes. So with that, we'll take a little of these until we're... next Tuesday. So we are back in order here at 3:05. Representative Peterson has joined us, and so has Representative Herron. Representative Seaton.
And Representative Millett.
Thank you.
And Representative Millett. If I didn't have a good and sharp committee, we'd never get done. So. As I said earlier, the intent today is to go HCR1, HCR3, HCR5, expecting that we'll take a little more time with HCR5, and it, we will not. We don't have any intention of passing that one today. Representative Peterson, if you come forward and tell us about HCR1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Pete Peterson of District 19, Muldoon. I'd like to thank you and the members of the committee for hearing this legislation today. I come before you with this piece of legislation brought to me by one of my neighbors in Northeast Anchorage. Kimberly McFadden contacted my office after her father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It was at this point that she realized that not only how deadly this disease was, but how little community recognition there was of pancreatic cancer. She was unable to find a single support group in the entire state of Alaska. With hopes that her father would not die in vain, she reached out to me to see if I could help. A resolution to raise awareness of pancreatic cancer and how truly deadly this disease is what we came up with. Currently, pancreatic cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States, yet it only receives 2% of the National Cancer Institute's research funding budget. Pancreatic cancer is one of only a few cancers that hasn't seen a dramatic rise in survival rates in the last 40 years. And it continues to kill 94% of the people affected within the 5 years that they're diagnosed. And the average life expectancy ranges from 3 to 6 months. This is the only major cancer with a 5-year life expectancy. The percentage of the survivors is in the single digits. Increased awareness will lead to expanded research into locating the disease's causes, enhancing early detection, and hopefully developing effective treatments. raise awareness will also lead to more knowledge about pancreatic cancer among Alaskans and directly enhance the good and well-being of our state's residents. And my staff is available to answer questions if anyone has any.
Mr. Ridley, Representative Heron has a question for you.
Representative Peterson, thank you for bringing this. Excuse me. So looking it over, I don't see any reference to possible causes of pancreatic cancer. We don't need a whereas that would list possible causes, or is there one in here?
Please identify yourself for the record.
David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson. There are a few risk factors involved, which are family history, disease, smoking, age, and diabetes. But that is not in one of the whereas. The resolution.
Do you want to follow up, Representative Aaron?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to. I have no intention of slowing this important resolution down, but maybe conceptual I would suggest. But I'm not making a motion.
Thank you. And I'll ask the sponsor if you'd be opposed to including a conceptual amendment to include those risk factors conceptually.
Mr. Chairman, no, that would be fine. There has been limited amount of research done on this, and so that's why we weren't sure that we could identify specific areas of risk other than the risk that we have found is more statistical than medical.
Yeah, and do you want to quick respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would. I guess it's common, unfortunately, in smokers and obese people. So, I mean, I would defer to the chairman and the sponsor if they choose to have a conceptual in there or not.
Yeah. If the sponsor said it's fine, and I think it can be worded myself so that we can say that the potentially identified risk factors are, or, you know, in other words, worded a little loosely so it doesn't sound like we have research that proves it, and then include that in the concept. Any other questions for the sponsor? Guess not. Getting off light today.
Do we have testifiers?
No.
I do have one question.
Oh, there is one question here.
I'm just curious. You mentioned symptoms, but you don't name any. What are? I mean, I don't know if there's symptoms of pancreatic cancer, but I don't know. I don't know what the symptoms. Do you know what the symptoms are?
Again, David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson. Some symptoms would include abdominal pain or back pain, weight loss, jaundice, a loss of appetite, nausea, changes in stool, and diabetes. And again, not enough research has been done to fully reach out and see what all the symptoms are. And so just kind of want to raise awareness to get more funding for research.
Okay, thank you.
I know we have some testimony on the bill, and so, but I don't. Okay, no more questions. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
I have nobody online that I know of that wants to testify. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to come forward, please? See and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, I'm Steve Thompson from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a House representative from House District 10. I'm here to speak in favor of House Concurrent Resolution Number 1. Recognizing the month of November as Pancreatic Aware Month will help get people to realize how devastating this disease is. It is one of the most painful deaths of any cancers. What you were asking about, my wife was 55 years old. She didn't smoke. She didn't drink. She was healthy, didn't have diabetes. And by the time that we found out what she had, it had already metastasized through the liver and over to the stomach. She didn't have any pain until just before we went in. and it was too late. And there's really nothing can be done even if you go in and get early detection. It's a death sentence if you get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It states here that in the, that there was 158 deaths from 2006 to 2008. My wife was one of those in 2007. Since my wife has passed away, I've had five people that I know personally and close that have all passed away from pancreatic cancer, one of them two nights ago. This brings awareness to pancreatic cancer. Hopefully we'll have people. My wife had acid reflux. That was all she had. She went to the doctor, and they gave her the little purple pills or whatever, you know, for acid reflux, and we did that for 3 or 4 months. But finally it got to the point where we went back in and said there's something else wrong. So there's no real detection for it, and it is a death sentence if you end up with it. And it's devastating, and hopefully this will bring more attention to pancreatic cancer. And I'm here to support the passage of House Concurrent Resolution Number 1.
Thank you for your testimony, Steve. Do we have any questions? Do you know, I could have asked the sponsor this, but if he wants to. I see you have the number of deaths, but I mean, one of the four leading causes. Is it quite a bit less? I mean, how do the others compare? The other causes, are they quite a bit bigger numbers?
I don't have the numbers. No, I do not have the total number.
Come on, you got an answer for that.
Thank you.
It's just a matter of perspective and interest, it isn't.
Again, David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson. So your question, the numbers go, number one is lung cancer at 28%. Number two is colon cancer at 10%. Number three is breast cancer at 7.5%. And number four is pancreatic cancer at 6%.
That helps get a perspective on it. Thank you. Is there anyone in the room left that would like to testify, or anybody online? If not, we'll close public testimony with committee discussion. Representative Heron, did you want to make a conceptual amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that for a conceptual amendment that pancreatic cancer is more common in smokers and people that are obese. You know, and Mr. Chairman, I would ask that your staff and the sponsor staff create the appropriate whereas. Thank you.
It's one of the whereases, and I think we've got enough on the record there to go with. And what's the wish of the committee?
Do you have a motion? Okay. I make the motion to move.
Question.
Mr. Chairman, did we adopt that amendment?
You moved it. I saw no objection, and I didn't say it. I'm sorry. I see no objection. The conceptual amendment is adopted. Thank you, Paul. Yeah. Now, can we have an amendment?
I move House Concurrent Resolution Number 1, 27-LS0062/A, from committee with individual recommendations. And conceptual amendment.
As conceptual.
Thank you.
And zero is closed. Okay, the staff went up and got the book, so please don't leave until I guess passed around. But what we're going to do is just press right on here to go to the next bill, which is HCR3. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Yeah. I see the sponsor out there for HCR3. And her capable staff. Identify yourself and please proceed with your. We have in front of us, by the way, version A of HCR3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy Munoz. I represent District 4 here in Juneau, along with Representative Curtula in District 3. And it's a pleasure to be before your committee. Thank you for hearing the bill, or the resolution, rather. HCR 3 raises awareness to the problem of elder abuse. And when I was first, when I first came into contact with individuals that had had direct experience with this issue, I was quite surprised to learn that this is a growing problem in Alaska. I know we've heard nationally on the media, in the media, that it is becoming a serious concern in, across the country. But here in Alaska, the Department of Health and Social Services reports an increase in 169% in the reports of harm to elders. And the Ombudsman's Office for Long-Term Care has seen a corresponding increase in reports of approximately 200% over the last 3 years. These are allegations of self-neglect, abuse, neglect, general neglect, and financial exploitation. I bring this to your attention specifically at the request of the Alaska Commission on Aging, and here today to speak specifically to the problems that are encountered around Alaska is Denise Daniello with the Commission. And I appreciate your support and am here to answer questions, but we'll call on Denise to answer specific questions from an agency standpoint. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for the sponsor? I have one. an hour before, you know, for you, this is for you, though.
Oh, for me.
Yeah. We haven't gotten to Danielle. She's signed up here, and we'll get her up here. Is it okay with you? The committee has copies of the conceptual amendment, and I just want to put on the record it.
Yes, sir. I saw the amendment, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah. Okay. All it does is add a little bit of emphasis on the families involvement. Representative Miller?
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Munoz, for bringing this forward. Do we have a nice, tight definition or a loose definition of who we're talking about, elders? Is there a number attached to that?
Senior citizens.
65.
65 and older.
Okay.
65. I'm sorry.
60?
60 and older.
Do I hear 62.
Denise, if you would come up and join the sponsor.
All right.
Then we can get some of this on the record so that.
Thank you. And I apologize for not having the specific.
Quite all right.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Denise Daniello, and I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. And I didn't see who asked the question.
Representative Miller asked the question.
Representative Miller, through the chair, the target age is 60 years and older. And the reason why we targeted that age, because that is the age for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, that they respond to reports of abuse. As well as that is the age, too, that people who receive services funded through the Older Americans Act. So that's an important service sector that we consider for seniors. So part of this bill is also to not only to encourage a public awareness campaign about the different types of elder abuse and the prevalence of mistreatment, but also calls upon greater coordination of agencies who serve elders with promoting their safety. And so those agencies that would be identified are people who are agencies who respond to people 60 years and older. Okay. So that was the reason why that age was chosen.
Follow up. And of course, my next question is do we also have a strict definition or a loose working definition for abuse? I'm certainly thinking it can manifest itself in a number of ways.
Yes. Representative Miller.
Identify yourself and start talk so that just your name again. So.
Okay, this is Denise Daniello, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. And Representative Miller, there are many different types of abuse. That in each one has its own characteristics, signs. So there is, of course, physical abuse that's manifested physically, bruising, you know, cuts, scrapes, could be broken bones. There's also emotional abuse, which is the withdrawal of affection. There is abandonment when a senior is in the trusted care of a caregiver who may be, you know, a family member or a professionally employed caregiver, and that person leaves that person, the elder person, so that would be abandonment. There's also neglect, where the elder is not receiving, you know, the basics of food, water, and care, maybe not their medicine. They may be also locked in, you know, in their bedroom and not allowed out. I mean, there's different types of neglect. And there's also sexual abuse. And so I don't know if I need to go into that. And financial exploitation, which is, I think, the second highest type of abuse that's reported to Adult Protective Services. That's at 19.2%, and that can take a variety of forms. Could be, you know, from a caregiver taking advantage of a person's financial finances or their assets. In a rural setting, it could also take a different form. It could be misusing a person's fishing license. Mm-hmm. Okay, that could be a form of financial exploitation. It could be the elder receiving something through the mail about sending somebody money that they don't know, and they respond to that. That's financial exploitation. And then there's also the highest type of abuse is self-neglect. And this is the situation when somebody who suspects abuse of a person or self-abuse, where that person's not taking care of themselves, they notice changes in that person's physical appearance, in their surroundings, and they would report that observation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm assuming you're going to be here if there are other questions come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for bringing the bill forward. Marie Darlin is here to testify. If you would come up. No stranger to this committee. I think we all know Marie.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm coordinator of AARP's Capital City Task Force. That's why you see me here so many times. We are here in support of this bill and have been aware for some time of the many problems that actually come to the fore at different times regarding the abuse of your retirees and seniors. And we feel this bill at least, I mean, this resolution will at least put some maybe better focus on some of the problems that have been coming to the forefront now in the last 2 or 3 years particularly. And the information, as Denise has told you and Kathy also, that it's the increase in all of the calls that have been gotten everywhere from Adult Protective Services to the Ombudsman's Office and all that on all the different problems that they have been made aware of. And so, therefore, that's why we are really concerned that this be made a little more public, the public be made aware of it, so that then you can have a better idea of people who know about these kinds of things are then going to make the proper reports and try and then work together to do something about it. And the things, you have a letter from us, which should have come in no later than this morning, about the different policies and all that AARP is guided by on this, which goes all the way from the protection of the person and their freedoms and their rights. And then, of course, when you start really looking at and you've already gone through a lot of this with some of the bills you've already passed, in which you have to have your enforcement issues there. You have to have an educational component that actually gets out and tries once again to make the public aware that these things are going on, and if they see signs of it, they should report it to the proper person. But then you have all these agencies that are working all this who need maybe to do a little more working together to try and address this issue and then do something about it. And that's what you would be asked to do when you start passing laws regarding this. So with that, we would just ask you to really look at what we've listed here as the policies that we really look at when it comes to personal and legal rights, you know, regarding these issues. So with that, we just want to say we support it and hope that this will then do some good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're coming to testify does exactly what we'd, I'm sure, the sponsor hoped, and that is raise awareness and education. So thank you, Marie. Diane Weber, I believe you're online.
Yes, for the record, this is Diana Weber, State of Alaska Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for giving me the opportunity to testify, and thanks to Representative Munoz for putting this resolution forward. Of course, I support it very strongly, because I believe that the resolution will help raise the profile of elder maltreatment in the Alaskan public's imagination. Your endorsement gives it weight. And there are many of us in the field who feel that elder maltreatment today is sort of where child abuse was 20 years ago, when people were just discovering that how pervasive it really was. And I also believe the resolution is important because it communicates to all state agencies that this is a priority for you, our legislators, and that you want state agencies to coordinate efforts to create the best possible system of protection. And I won't echo what the other folks have said. They've been germane and to the point. I agree with all of it. And that is what I would like to offer today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Diana. Anybody else in the room that would like to testify? There's three or four here that put a no by their name. I'm glad you came. But I think we covered everybody. Anybody else online? Okay. We'll close public testimony, HCR 3, committee discussion.
Thank you. Thank you to the sponsor for bringing the resolution up. I think this is one of the toughest things, and there's a lot of tough things that we deal with here in the committee, but when we had you up here talking about elder abuse and the different things that have happened in homes, it's devastating to hear our most valued and knowledgeable citizens in the state are subjected to this kind of abuse without really a voice. And so I think that this resolution is a positive step in giving that abuse, raising the curtain on it, and you know, if we can do more, please let us know, because I think it is one of the most important things that we're dealing with on a abuse issue right now. So thank you very much to the sponsor for bringing this forward.
Representative Harris.
excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Going to the resolution itself, page 2, lines 14 in 18, we have percentage reports harm filed have risen. I guess to the sponsor or to Denise, has the state continued to respond to these reports with appropriate levels of intervention?
Could we ask Denise, would you come back up, please? We'll reopen the public testimony. So Denise, did you get the question, or would you like to have it restated?
Again, for the record, my name is Denise Daniello with the Commission on Aging. I don't feel comfortable answering that question. I think it should be asked of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office and Adult Protective Services, because they can respond much more knowledgeably than I can.
Diana, are you still online?
I am.
Would you identify yourself and respond to Representative Herron's question? And if you like, we'll repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Diana Weber again, State of Alaska Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And my answer would be yes. I will speak mostly for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, but I would say that in our work with APS and with our investigators, we are responding, particularly in cases of imminent harm, within one working day, but we're really scrambling to do it. And I think that where the work may suffer is that we can't spend as long with some of the seniors as we would like to make sure that they get connected to all of the services they need, because we're busy rushing off to the next case. It's pretty pressing.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Diana. Okay, we'll close public testimony again. And before any more questions, what I'm going to do is move conceptual amendment number one for HCR3.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you. All it does on page 2, line 23, inserts the word families and before the word communities. Page 2, line 23. So that whereas would read, whereas the protection of the older Alaskan is a societal responsibility that requires family and communities and agencies across the state to work together. And then also in the same amendment, on page 2, line 28, is insert a new subparagraph there under there. Be it therefore resolved that the Alaska State Legislature recognizes that the family and community can provide the essential source of security and well-being for vulnerable older Alaskans. And the word can is the idea that potentially they, you know, not that it would be. And then also page 3, line 4. Insert another new paragraph there. It would be that the legislature therefore supports efforts by health and social services to enable independent living and supporting family services to enable independent living. And that ties with the first whereas in the bill. And I've talked briefly with the sponsor about it, and if anyone wants to help me wordsmith those, that's fine. It was rather quick. but conceptually, I think you got the idea. Seeing no comments, do you want to maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection.
Any further objection? Okay. Conceptual amendment number one is adopted. Any final comments on HCR3? Wish of the committee, vice chair. Would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion that we move the bill 27-LS0389/A.
Okay.
With the conceptual amendment, as amended.
And individual recommendations. Seeing no objections, bill passes. Thank you. Yeah, enjoy your afternoon.
Where's that seat? Let's get that seat.
The more you say, the more you get used to it.
We took the easy stuff first.
Yeah. Right? Are you ready, Paul?
It'd take a little bit easier to move fast. Is HCR 5, sponsor Representative Paul Seaton is here. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Appreciate you hearing this resolution today. I actually think it's one of the most important things we can be looking at, because what we're talking about is moving from a treatment of disease model of healthcare to a prevention of disease model. And all of that in tunes as far as the emotional health and actual financial costs that we absorb across this state. Today, by the way, Paul Seaton, Representative District 35, and with me is Crystal Rogers. She's my UAS intern who's been working so diligently on this resolution and will have the answers for your questions as we proceed along. I would like to today go through a overview of some of the information we have. If you've had a chance to read the resolution, you'll see that there are numerous whereases, and each one deals with a specific condition that scientific evidence has shown is impacted by vitamin D. And of course, vitamin D in Alaska is one of those things that we're in short supply on. We have very few studies. We have one from Fairbanks, and we have one from, which was back in 1989, master's thesis. And we have a very good study from Ketchikan, done by Native Health down there. And the average range was 6 to 16 nanograms per milliliter. Now, I know when we start talking about nanograms per milliliter, it all gets like, what are those? It's just a measurement in the blood of what the blood level of the converted vitamin D is. So before we get started, I wanted to explain that vitamin D is made in the skin with sunlight, with ultraviolet B radiation. Ultraviolet A radiation is what you feel most heat from and what causes sunburns. Ultraviolet B is absorbed very easily, so if you're inside a pane of glass, none of the UVB comes through. If the sun is low on the horizon, even though it's a nice warm day, just coming through that much atmosphere, all of the ultraviolet B is absorbed in the atmosphere. So even on a nice sunny day, you don't get any in Alaska for between 7 and 8 months of the year. And so it's very much of a problem for Alaska, and we probably have the lowest levels of vitamin D of any place in the nation. So with that, I will just, let me say one other thing about vitamin D. And you'll hear vitamin D2 and vitamin D3. D2 is a plant-based vitamin D, exposing plant to certain kinds of light create that. That's only available through prescriptions. There have been a number of studies, and vitamin D is what what animals actually make in their skin when they're exposed to UVB radiation, sunlight, and that is the same thing that is now almost universally available in supplements, whether they're the little pills like these or whether they're liquids. Those are all D3. And then D3 is converted in your skin to a pre-hormone and converted to 25-OHD, and you'll see that referenced in a lot. And that's the circuit, how vitamin D affects the body and is converted in your body to a hormone, which then works in your body. So just wanted to give a little background on those things before we get started. So let's go ahead, and we're looking at this again is vitamin D3, and it's produced when you have UV, and that's UVB light, if not UVA, and it's not really a vitamin, but it's a pre-hormone. And then where are your sources of vitamin D? Well, you can see we're in pretty good shape with wild salmon up there, some of the highest levels, 600 to 1,000 international units, whereas farmed salmon only has 100 to 250 in the same 3.5-ounce portion. But as you go down the list, you'll see that even though we have fortified things such as juices and milk, an 80-ounce glass of milk will only have 100 international units. Well, that's fine if you're worrying about rickets, which is it takes about 400 international units per day to prevent rickets. However, if you're looking for getting your blood levels to where they will be satisfactory for preventing other kinds of things, and we'll go through cancers and all. You might have to drink 40 glasses of milk a day. Most of us don't do that. So what are our other sources? And that's what we will be looking at here. And you can see that in all the time we work on these things, you can see it says Caucasian skin produces approximately 10,000 international units with 20 to 30 minutes of sun exposure. Now, that's with 40% of your body, your skin exposed. And so in Alaska, you know, we have a hard time with that anyway. But the more melanin you have in your skin, the darker your skin is, the less vitamin D you make, and the older you get, the less vitamin D you make with the same sun exposure. So when people are talking about an amount that you get from sun exposure, you got to realize that the darker your skin is, the less you make, and the older you are, the less you make with the same exposure. Okay. And here's what we try and do once in a while, but it just doesn't work because here in winter, even if we sunbathe out in the snow, there isn't it. That's not me. Just so you know, I won't play. It is in short supply in the tissues, and what happens is that there's a couple of videos that I'm not going to show you, but I'll reference you to. You can go see where at the University of California Television, there's a number of different presentations by doctors about how the biological interactions in your body work, and how the theory is that vitamin D actually works to keep your cells tightly connected so that they reproduce at the same rate. That's some of the newer theories of how cancers form. And so vitamin D is very necessary for that by unlocking the DNA cell libraries. Okay. So what are the consequences of not having enough vitamin D? You know, we have bone diseases. The most notable one was rickets. There's also on young children, you hear a hot cross bun where the skull is a little bulged and a little narrow in the front. That's from not having enough vitamin D, but not quite to the rickets level. Hypertension, cardiac disease, premature low-weight babies, and increased numbers of cesareans, diabetes. A real important one is periodontal disease, as we find in a lot of the villages and a lot of places in Alaska. There's tremendous tooth and gum problems, and that's related to low vitamin D. Decreased resistance to infections and various cancer, and multiple sclerosis is something that is very dependent on vitamin D. And as we find in the literature, that some of these things happen at one stage of life, so that a female that is from the Southwest is protected pretty much for their lifespan. If you're from the North, then you'll have five times the rate of multiple sclerosis, no matter if you go to a southern climate after you're 10 years old. So there's some very interesting things that your system establishes. So the question is, do we need a new health policy in the state? And that's one that concentrates on prevention of disease. So if we look at what some of the common cancers are, colon cancer and mortality rates. This is the actual mortality rates by counties across the United States. And you'll notice the Northeast is the highest in the nation. And part of that was hard to understand for a long time, but you can see how much sunshine there is. In the lower part of the U.S., you have much less. And in the upper Midwest and the East, well, it turns out that there's a lot of coal-fired power plants, and it's not that the coal, but the particles in suspension in the air are very, very good absorbers of UVB. And so this is the same thing that happened with rickets when the huge ricket epidemics took place at the start of the Industrial Revolution in England. They were burning coal. There wasn't much sunlight. People were living in towns. They were no longer out in the countryside exposed, but they were in streets, and sunshine didn't get through. And so you had high incidence of some diseases. So if we look at what some of the studies show, this is one from 1997, and looking at the risk of colon cancer compared to your level of your blood serum 25-OHD. Remember, that is the measure of your circulating vitamin D. And if you look at the reference numbers down in the 6, which is some of Alaskans have that, compared to if you have even 23 nanograms per milliliter, you'll see that there's a 50% reduction if you're in the group that has the higher levels of vitamin D than if you have the lower levels of vitamin D in your blood. Here's another study, and this study, Feskanich, again, the same kind of relationship. This study showed that the lowest group, the lowest one-fifth of the population, had an average of 15 nanograms per milliliter. So what they've done is they've taken and looked at the entire population in the study, and then what they did is they took and measured the vitamin D levels and said, okay, if we look at the lowest fifth of the population, how much colon cancer did they have? The next fifth, so breaking the population into 5 sections and then looking at the cancer rates based on which portion of that population they were in. And you can see that with at 37 or 38 nanograms per milliliter, you only had half the likelihood of getting colon cancer as if you were in the lower group. And then here's meta-analysis, which a meta-analysis just means you take all the studies and you lump them together. And lumping them all together, you can see that they have the studies together show that about 34 nanograms per milliliter has a 50% likelihood or 50% relative risk of colon cancer. And then there's just another study here, and this is looking at mortality. So this is people that are diagnosed with colon cancer, and what is their relative risk of death at, I forget how many years this is, like 3 years later. And if, when you are analyzed with your colon cancer, you had less than 20 nanograms per milliliter, that's just taken as one. And the people that had greater than 32 had a 70% reduction in their relative risk of being dead just a few years later. So these are the studies that we're looking at. And one of the things that I would like to just clarify is because we hear several terms. One is population studies or observational study, and the other thing is a double-blind randomized control. And a double-blind randomized control means you take a very select group of people that are, you know, all have a disease, and then you treat them with something, and you see how they respond. Well, that tells you how people with a disease will respond to a treatment, but that doesn't tell you how the population responds generally, because you are only looking at a very select group of people. Most of these studies that we're looking at here are looking at the population as a whole and what their relative risk is depending upon how much you have. And then here's another hazard. This is again a hazard death ratio of colon cancer, and you can see that those that had 16 nanograms per milliliter were set at whatever their rate was, that was set at 1. And so you can see if you go out to 40, you have about a 50% less risk of dying once you were diagnosed. So let's go to breast cancer. You see the same kind of a figure, and that is that the more sun you get in the southern part of the United States, the less risk you have. Again, you have going north a higher risk. And go ahead to this is the Women's Health Initiative. They were looking at 295 people that had See, I'm not sure. Anyway, this one looked at the same kind of thing, and the lower quartile there was, had an average of 12, and the upper quartile had an average of about 23, and at about 22, you had 50% risk if you were in that population of getting breast cancer. That, again, that's odds ratio. Here's a meta-analysis of breast cancer risk. Again, this was combining all the studies. You have, if you're in the group, the one-fifth of the population that has the average of 10, you are, you know, twice as likely a relative risk of those that have 50. Here's another individual study, and this was looking at breast cancer risk and same kind of results. All of these studies are slightly different. In other words, this one has 48, and the other one was 50 nanograms. So these are individualized studies. It's not just one. The meta-analysis is what puts them together. And then we can look again at the hazard death ratio. Here's 512 women that had breast cancer, and at diagnosis, if they were if they had a blood serum level of less than 20, they were 40%. If you had over 30, compared to those that were that had under 20, you had a 40% less chance of dying, and I think this was a four-year study following them. So what's the mechanism of action? And Dr. Haney that was here had some of the presentations that you can go to grassrootshealth.org and see those presentations, or you can go to University of California Television and the San Diego School of Medicine, and the presentations are available there as well. One of the things we've been looking at is influenza, and this was a study where they had 208 African-American postmenopausal women, and they gave them 800 IUs for 2 years, and then they increased it to 2,000 in the third year, and you can see the difference in the influenza rates that were had. Those that had a placebo had 30 cases of influenza. The other half of the group that had vitamin D in those levels had 8. So a fourfold increase for the group that had the placebo versus those that had the vitamin D. Another study was Japanese school children, and they looked at Japanese school children and gave them 1,200 IUs a day, and followed them through, and the difference was that you had about a 60% reduction in influenza and upper respiratory disease among the school children that had the vitamin D. Going on to diabetes, which is a huge problem here in Alaska. This is the NHANES, the National Health Assessment, that's done, and there are 6,000 adults in this. You can see, again, in the lowest quartile was assigned a risk of 1, and you can see that if you're in the higher quartile, which is 40 or above, you have an 80% or 70 to 80% lower risk of getting diabetes. And there's a presentation on the UCTV.tv website that you can go to and look about diabetes and vitamin D and can you prevent it. Here's a very interesting study that was done on infants and vitamin D supplementation. And this is in northern Finland. And this is a 30-year study. So what they did is they looked at people that kids that got vitamin D, and they had the low amounts of vitamin D, which was in later years, or the higher amounts, and you can see that it was a relative risk. Actually, it was like 86% less risk of developing type 1 juvenile diabetes over a 30-year lifespan In other words, following that cohort of children for each one of those years, because they have a national health insurance or national health program, and so they follow the kids through, and the recommendations go out to all of the doctors, and so they're following those. You know, we have some, we have a hard time getting information because one clinic or one doctor isn't required to share that information. In fact, in many cases, are required to keep that information confidential. In Finland, it's the exact opposite. So at least for research purposes, we find a lot. So if we look at how that that was in 1966 or 60, yeah, in 64, the recommendation, and prior to that was 4,500 IUs per day for the first year of life. And they changed that to 2,000 IUs in 1964. And you can see that it kicked along at, you know, about 25 incidents per 100,000 kids. And then in 1975, they changed that recommendation to 1,000 IUs, and it started, you know, it was going up. And then in 1992, they went to the American recommendation of 400 IUs, and you can see what happened to the rates. Now, remember, those are cohorts, so the 1995 kids, as they go along, it gets higher and higher because more kids over time are developing that type 1 diabetes. Yes.
Do you mind if we interrupt?
No, that's fine. Questions? Sure.
This is going to tie to a question I have later on anyway. And you made a statement when you started that. But first, let me back up a little bit. I really am grateful that you are fascinated with this topic and that you have brought it in front of us. I also am taking more vitamin D than I, you know, and I even, you know, I had a blood test and found out that I was low, you know. And so, I mean, it's with gratitude, and I appreciate this. So please don't misinterpret questions. When you started, you said that we have scientific evidence supporting. I'm sure you would agree that that's not the same as it's proven.
Absolutely. This is looking at population studies and which part of the population or which population do we want to have the Alaskans in. I mean, we have the data that says that your relative risk, if you have adequate vitamin D in your blood, is much less. Does that prove that? Because we haven't taken people and said, okay, you're not going to have vitamin D, and we're going to see whether you develop cancer. This is looking at the populations as they exist and looking at the levels of vitamin D. Now, are there other things? There is genetics that allow some people to utilize vitamin D better than others. This is not this is just looking at the population. So we can't say that you as a particular person, if you take a certain amount of vitamin D, we can guarantee one outcome or another. That would be a randomized control trial, and it's very difficult to do, especially when you're talking about nutrients instead of drugs.
The scientific evidence that has been presented by you, you know, and from the doctor that was here, very convincing and very well done. But like on this graph right here, we're talking about three different points in time there where there's a change in amount of vitamin D recovered, but there's a lot of variables in Finland, right? It's Finland?
Finland, yes. Yeah. It's Arctic.
There's other variables that we have no idea what else was going on. You know, there could have been something else happened in 1995. The only reason I'm bringing this up, Paul, is that when we get into the wording of the resolution itself, I'd like to at least have a discussion around some of the terminology to change it from this is the way it is to this is potentially, you know, and I got several suggestions in that arena, and I just wanted to throw that on the table.
Sure, and that's fine, and obviously, you know, all we can do is look at correlations. I mean, we can go back and we can say, you know, the kids, we can be pretty well confident that when they had the national health care that the doctors did follow the recommendations, because it was, you know, otherwise they were out of compliance with the medical directions that the doctors were supposed to follow. So we can be much more sure that these recommendations were followed than we could if there's just something published in the literature, because this comes from the government, and it was government insurance, or not government insurance, but government health care. So, and we can look and see what the response is. We can't say that there wasn't something else that happened in 1992. We do know that in 1992, for some reason, and nobody's been able to figure out why they reduced their recommendation to the 400 IUs. People have asked, and it's just like they haven't been able to find out.
Representative Millett. Representative Seaton, when I went in to get vitamins, one of the things that my doctor was real firm with was that when you take certain vitamins, you need to take other supplements so that you absorb those supplements better. So with vitamin D, is there any other supplement that you should take in conjunction with vitamin D to make your body absorb the vitamin D?
Sure, and thank you for the question through the chair. Calcium and vitamin D are integral. Vitamin D is necessary to properly use calcium. That's why, for bone health, that's why muscular health, that's why a lot of these cancers that we're experiencing are related to epithelial cells. It doesn't matter whether it's breast cancer, and so you're talking about the lining of the ducts, or you're talking about colon cancer, and you're talking about the lining of the intestine or stomachs or bladder cancer. There's 40% reduction in bladder cancer. Those are linings, so there's a pretty good idea of how those mechanisms work, but, it's not proven. There's theories. There's theories of what causes cancer, and they've got pretty good indications of that. But as far as what else you need calcium, adequate calcium. Vitamin D lets you use your calcium appropriately and control it. Also, if people are taking vitamin D in larger amounts, sometimes they'll get a skin rash or something. The evidence is that some people are also low in magnesium, and magnesium is very hard to measure. And I think that you in your packet, you have an article on that at the back. And so often, but when you use your vitamin D and convert it to 25-OHD for your body, you do use up magnesium. So sometimes if someone is having a side effect to taking vitamin D, it's often what it is. It's a side effect because they're low in magnesium. They were low in magnesium before, but when they get additional vitamin D, they can further lower their magnesium. So magnesium is the one other thing that they talk about that you should probably have, as well as calcium, magnesium, and vitamin D.
No, that's good.
When you just to clarify, because that's great. My comment was in this particular graph, and I realize that taking this graph, I'm not making a point that attacks what you're saying at all, because it's a combination of all the different evidence that you're bringing forward. But I'm just I was having a science background. We were trained, and I think you too, to be skeptical. And it's okay, to be critical. And what I was just going to, the reason I picked this graph, sure, is that there are three points identified: 1964, 1975, and 1992. And that puts a context. But if you took that off there and look at the graph, you'd say, oh, it's been increasing, and it's increasing more recently. We don't know if maybe in 1995 they began to use a different procedure for homogenizing milk or something. There's a lot of things that could be in here. So when
sure,
all I'm doing is saying we need to be cautious with all this. And even if you take it all together, you just can't say this is fact. This is what it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And these are observational studies, and they're correlations, and they're relative risks of, when you have a population here and the population here. But can you say that if you change the person from a low level to that person to the high level, can you definitively say that their risk is going to go down 50%? No, you can. You're comparing populations. So, yeah, I fully agree with what you're talking about, and I'm I'm sorry, Representative Heron had asked me about a question earlier, and I'd forgotten.
That's what the signal was. I thought I wasn't close enough to the mic. I'm sorry, Representative Heron. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have two questions, but one of them is around the subject that the questions have been in. You give overwhelming evidence here that vitamin D is good in all these other medical challenges. So wouldn't we want to have a resolve that says vitamin D can safely be used in conjunction with standard medical treatments? In fact, it will increase the treatment's effectiveness. Wouldn't that make sense? Because, Mr. Chairman, to the sponsor, you have several whereases where you prove that it works. So wouldn't we want to have a resolve at the end saying that it does help standard medical treatments?
And I think that, through the chair, Representative Heron, I think that there'll be some people testifying from the medical community that doctors are actually prescribing those things. I am like Representative Keller. I'm not wanting to go out and make a statement that I can guarantee something. I can tell you that the evidence that I've seen is that those women that are being treated for breast cancer at the four-year or five-year mark, those that had higher levels of vitamin D were 50% more likely to still be alive than those that had low levels of vitamin D. The doctors that are talking, the nephrologists, the guys who work on kidneys from back in New York, they will say that, you know, they can't show you the same thing. They can't, but that every one of their patients, they have on the high end of the 40 to 60 range. Otherwise, they would consider it not doing an adequate job in their medical profession. But can they, you know, that's one of the, one of the videos you can watch on a presentation to the other doctors at the second annual conference that they had in April of 2010 at University of California San Diego Medical School was they said, I can't prove this because I don't have the studies, but I would not proceed with any of my patients without having them on vitamin D. But I'm not a doctor. I can't prescribe things. I can just point out to folks that that's what the medical community is saying to when at medical conferences.
Mr. Chairman, while we're here, shouldn't we have a resolve that basically gives a warning that you should make sure that it's vitamin D3, not vitamin D2?
And through the chair, Representative Heron, the medical community says that both are effective, that you know to get vitamin D2 now you have to have a prescription. If your particular doctor for some reason wants you to take vitamin D2, maybe you're allergic to, you know, animal proteins or something or that, and they would want to prescribe that. So pretty much if you go to get vitamin D now, it will be D3 unless you get a prescription, because that's D2 now requires a prescription. But looking at the effects of when they have given people both D2 and D3, they really don't see a difference in the outcomes. In most cases, there's some slight difference, but not a whole lot. So there hasn't been enough for the scientific community to come out and say that everybody should necessarily go to one form or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
And so the next one here is looking at cancers, and this is all cancers, and this was Lappy et al. And median achieved. And what they did is they looked at the relative risk of 1,100 people, and this was a randomized control four-year study, people 55 to 85, and those that, you know, they received 1,100 units of vitamin D. Those that had less than 29 nanograms per milliliter compared to those that had more than 29 nanograms per milliliter, there was 68% lower risk of any kind of cancer in those that had above 29. Now, as you can see from this chart over here on the wall, there's a wide variation for individuals on those bars. Those are all, that's 3,000 or that's 6,000. This 3,600 people that were taking those different doses. But you can see that's a high bar. So just because somebody takes 5,000 IU a day, it doesn't mean they all convert the same amount to this measure, which is a 25-OHD. So here we had a case where cancer risk, everybody was getting 1,100 units, but it depended upon what your serum level was as to whether you had a 68% less likelihood of getting any cancer or compared to the other group. So the people that are in that lower group, the less than 29, they're going to have to take more. This was 1,100 units. They may have to take 3,000, 4,000 international units to get themselves into the upper range to move their level of vitamin D in their circulating blood higher. So it's very individualized as far as the dose response.
Yeah, just a question. That red line is what is that's the desirable level of
the red line on the chart is the average. You see those doses go from like 1,000 to 10,000, and you can see the average goes up. It doesn't go up really steeply, but it goes.
It's the average of the actual D in your that has been converted in your body.
That's right. That's the average of that line, that the population in that line.
Right. So if you go to the far right, that where the black dots are, it actually looks like the majority of the people in that. That are taking 10,000 units a day are below the red line still.
Right? Well, the red line is the average. So the average, if they're taking 10,000, is 80 nanograms per milliliter.
Okay, I did misunderstand the graph. Okay.
So the average here is about 80, and the average here is about 60.
Okay, I was misreading the graph. Well, I asked the question. Thank you.
So let's go on and look at tuberculosis and vitamin D. And tuberculosis has been shown to be, quite beneficial. And let's go to the next slide, and we'll look at another the 2006 study that looked at 67 patients, and half of them received. The standard treatment, which is, antibiotics, and the other received the standard treatment, which is antibiotics, but one group received a placebo as well as their antibiotics, and the other received 10,000 international units of vitamin D instead of the placebo. And the way you check to see whether somebody's recovering is you check their sputum or their spit and see if there's any bacteria left in there, and at the end of a month, the placebo group had about the normal success ratio of treatment with antibiotics, and about 78% of the people had zero bacteria left. But those that were taking the vitamin D, 100% of the group had no bacteria left. So this is relating to what Representative Herron was just talking about. Does this work in other treatments? And here's a excellent example of the way in which vitamin D helps your own immune system work in conjunction with other treatments. It doesn't replace the treatment, but it helped work in treatment in conjunction so that you had this 100% elimination of all the bacteria with that.
So now it's my turn. That was a completely controlled study
of yes.
both groups, so that would, wow.
Yeah, that's a standardized treatment, and they were randomized to either have the 10,000 IUs or placebo. So it was a randomized controlled study.
for all other drugs and age groups and everything like that?
Yes. I mean, that it was a randomized controlled study in which they had the patients, and they either got the placebo or they got the vitamin D.
Thank you.
And then if we take a look, you know, there's the idea of vitamin D toxicity, and it does exist, and there have been people that have had toxicity. I think when Dr. Haney was here, he told us about some folks in Africa that had stolen the oil that was supposed to treat a bunch of milk and were using it for cooking oil, and it, you know, they were taking 1 million or 2 million units a day because they were cooking their eggs and things in this oil, which happened to be the extremely concentrated vitamin D. And of course, what happens is it doesn't work well for your calcium, and so your calcium doesn't start working in your body right, and you have to go through a number of things. But there's never been any body that's had toxicity from vitamin D that had less than 200 nanograms per milliliter. And if you go down to San Diego or down to the beaches in Acapulco or something, and you look at the guys that are out there on the beach doing the the lifeguards, mm-hmm. they will have 160, 180. So the body is, you know, not making too much at that point. But if you're taking it, there's no toxicity has been found in any of the studies by people taking less than under 30,000 units a day. So, but there have been toxicities if you're taking over 30,000 units per day, and nobody is recommending 30,000 units per day. But so anyway, just in summary, the scientific community and Grassroots Health, University of San Diego Medical School, has a panel of 40 international scientists. Their suggestion is that everybody should be in the range of 40 to 60 is where you should be. And so that's what we probably like to do, is see people get tested. There's really interesting little test kits now that one of the problems is if you, let's say we were in a village and say, well, we got to fly out a nurse and take blood samples and all that. You don't have to do that at all. What you do is they have these little kits, and comes with a little sticker, you know, pulls out, and you push it on your finger, and a little blade goes tick and makes a little hole. And then you have this little card, and you put two little drops of blood on that, let it dry 20 minutes, hold it up, put it in the envelope, send it in, and a week and a half later you get on your internet, because they've given you a control number that you put on here. And that way you get your vitamin D tested, and it's a $60, but it doesn't require all the sampling and the nurses and flying out and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, just wanted to show you that. And I think that's let's go just to this last one more. And this is a chart here that is using the reference point of 25 and looking at how much above or below, and what the data, the synopsis of the data shows that diseases, what percentage of those diseases your relative risk decreases. So that, for instance, if you were looking at multiple sclerosis, you could see if you were at 50, you would have a 46% less chance of having multiple sclerosis than if you were at 25. So this is a relative risks of the populations that have a 50, 25 OHD compared to the population that has 25. And one more, and that would just be that this is the Grassroots Health, where you can go and you can click on the videos or down this whole column on the right-hand side if you want to find out how vitamin D is thought to work in the body and the microbiology of it and everything else. That's where it's available. So Sorry it took so long, Mr. Chairman, but figured that this could explain it better than just talking with words about the resolution.
That was a great opportunity, I think. So, but you know, now what I'd like to do is go over the resolution itself, see these questions, so see where we're at, see if we have questions. I have a few, but
sure. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my staffer here has most of the studies here that if you wish to get any of those, and I think there's quite a few in the packet that were related to each whereas and where each one of those whereas was. And I think we just provided the abstract of the paper, but if you wish the scientific paper itself for any one of those whereases, we'd be happy to provide the entire scientific paper in the from the publication.
Any questions for Representative Seaton? Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Seaton, for that very informative presentation. Do we have knowledge of, and maybe this would be a further resolve at the end of this, in raising public awareness, are there good natural sources of vitamin D that are easily gotten? You know, you can't eat salmon in most parts of the country every day, even though some of us would like to. You know, is there a list of good sources that could also supply us with the adequate amount?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, there are some sources. One thing that was very unique in the literature was that the only population that get enough vitamin D through their diet is Alaska Native populations that are eating a traditional diet. If they're not eating a traditional diet, then they are very susceptible to being deficient as well. But if they're eating a traditional diet, and this is from the Inupiaia in Canada, because the records, again, with the Canadian system are better than ours. And they found this huge differentiation between those that were eating a traditional diet and whether it was those people that were not eating a traditional diet or the school teachers that were there, and huge amount of vitamin D deficiency among those that were not eating a very, you know, wild game and fatty foods, because vitamin D is fat-soluble, oil-soluble vitamin. It doesn't pass out of your system like vitamin C. It goes out with urine, and so it's very slow response. Vitamin D is contained in the fat and the oil, and so that's how in the native diet you pick that up. A lot of wild meat, a lot of you know, seal, those kind of things. And and since it's oil soluble, one thing that is very interesting is that the it doesn't matter when you take the dose. I mean, you can take, if you're taking 5,000 IU a day, you can take them all on Sunday. You can take seven of them on Sunday. Once a week, it doesn't matter. They actually were doing a lot of studies where they gave people 100,000 units at one point and then measured them over time. We've got those studies, and you can see that it takes about a month and a half for that to get down to the level where you're down to 40 nanograms per milliliter. But there's a lot of variability because it doesn't excrete from your system, because it stays in your system because it's oil soluble, and if that is the information you
I think that covered it pretty well. A follow-up, this may be, you know, completely out of your realm, but years ago I did a little bit of research into vitamins and came to discover that various vitamins can be more or less potent and actually do their job depending on how they're harvested, manufactured, stored, treated, etc. Do you have any knowledge of how the better forms of vitamin D, and let's say 3 in this case, are actually manufactured, you know, made available in either pill or tablet form, etc.?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, we asked Dr. Haney when he was up here about that. Normally what's happening is the manufacturers are apparently vitamin D is really cheap to manufacture. And so it's not something where it's an expensive thing that it that somebody could cheat a lot and do well. And normally what the pills have, like these little liquid gels or the others, have a potency that's good for about 18 months, and then it diminishes slightly. So they have found in their analyses that almost all of the vitamin D that's available will be a little stronger than, so if it says 4,000 IU, it may be 4,200 or 43, and they're probably counting on the manufacturer so that as time goes down, it still maintains its potency. On the, you all got a voucher, I don't know if everybody's redeemed them, but on that, that was actually from Costco online, and they actually have a date on there of 2012, and so manufacturers seem to be doing fairly well. And one of the things is that, you know, when we look at the costs, those, just so you know, those were $8.99 for a bottle of 500, and those were 5,000 international units, and those were ordered online. So it's, you know, you're talking about less than $10 a year if somebody was taking 5,000 IU. If somebody wanted to take 2,500 a day, if that's, you know, if they did their blood sample and found out, oh, well, I only need a little, they could take one every other day, or they could, you know, buy a different kind.
Representative, do you remember where Dr. Heaney talked about the natural vitamin D? I can't remember what he called it. There's a natural form that's more expensive, he said, than something else.
Well, there's calciferol, which is the kind you manufacture, and that's D3, and there's ergosiferol, which is a plant-based one, which is D2, and those were, that's the one that you're, the prescription, and, you know, there are some people that are strictly vegans that don't want anything that has anything to do with, that was based on oils, you know, so they might want to do that. So there are methods.
I got a series of things on the wording that I'd like to just ask you how you'd respond. Page 1, line 10, actually 9 and 10. It says, whereas a high incidence of preventable diseases that are correlated with insufficient blood serum levels of vitamin D are correlated is a little bit strong for my taste. I'd like to say are correlated with insufficient blood serum levels of vitamin D in numerous studies. That would just qualify a little bit.
Sure.
I don't think anybody get in trouble with that. Page 3, when you get down to line 22 through 26, I am uncomfortable with that because it pits vitamin D preventative treatment against vaccines. Is that what you intended to do, to have that in there? Is that important to you or what? It just seems like, you know, this is a highly political arena when you start talking about natural foods versus, you know, I mean, it's just somebody's going to have a real strong opinion. And to promote vitamin D in a positive sense is one thing, you know, but to say, to start pitting it against the vaccine, even though there are studies that make you pretty skeptical, and me too, about the effectiveness of influenza vaccines, flu vaccines. I was just wondering if how important that section, those two whereases are to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important in the aspect that the state of Alaska, as of January 1st, abandoned its universal flu vaccines for the population. And that's why this is important, is do we have another way of doing that since the state has abandoned its universal vaccines? It used to be that we subsidized vaccines for the entire population. We had Senator Stevens knowing that influenza was a very big problem up here, had gotten some extra money through, and then that came out, and the administration just this last year decided that public health was not going to. They'll still do it for the very at-risk populations, that is through public health for kids under 5 or 6, I believe, and for folks that are over I'm guessing now, I think it's 65 or something like that, for the elderly and the very young, public health will supply vaccines, but they're not doing that for the rest of the population anymore. So the question is, you know, the Center for Disease Control said in their studies, this is the effectiveness of vaccines, and the studies that we've shown here, the Japanese school children and the 308 postmenopausal women showed that the it was 70%, which is kind of in the same range of where the effectiveness was for shown by the Center for Disease Control. So I guess what I'm hoping is that we can push towards preventative medicine for everyone, and since it balances fairly well with a program that the state has just basically abandoned, I think it gives us a good substitution. But that's what that's in there for. It's not in there to knock vaccines. It's just relatively speaking, there are two things there that are kind of shown by different studies, and the one that might question vaccines would be by the Center for Disease Control, not anything else.
We don't have to answer it now. We can continue the discussion later, but I am contemplating a amendment to delete those two, and the reason is that, yes, it does pit one against the other, and the vaccine development and distribution and all that, as you know, is a big industry, and it's a moving target. And I just, you know, to me, the comparison may harm more than it helps, but that, for what it's worth.
Sure.
And then on page 5, down on line 25, I would suggest, you know, please consider, make note, we can talk about it later, we don't have to solve it now, it's getting late, but on 25, after the word could, before the word be, put potentially in there, so agreed, used to treat diseases or illnesses that could potentially be prevented with adequate blood serum levels of vitamin D, and I know that you have provided.
Sure, that's right.
And then down, same thing. Well, there's several times that appears, I guess, on the next page, on lines, page 6 on line 2, over by long-term, just before long-term, could include that. Page and then page 6, line 6, before the word prevent, the next last word there, potentially prevent. And then, are you okay when you say use the word testing there on line 2, page 6?
Line 2, page 6?
Or line 6, I'm sorry, line 6, page 6, line 2, there we go. Testing, is that, I was thinking maybe research, because there's ongoing research.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, what I was talking about was blood testing.
So I could put maybe the word blood in there.
Blood testing?
Yeah, but maybe it's clear, and I was reading it too quick, but let's consider that. The other thing that I had trouble with, and I'm in a quick read of the hypothetical, fiscal note saw the department had the same concerns as when you use the word provide in on page 6, again, line 6, and on, use it twice. Oh, let's see, where's the other one? Well, down in the last resolve there, provide, yeah, line 12, the word provide. I just want to highlight it as something we need to look at.
Sure.
Yeah, because it does...
And Mr. Chairman, this is a resolution requesting the state to look at doing this. It doesn't require them to do it. You know, hopefully we will go to a prevention model and they will consider providing this, but it doesn't require the department to do it. But hopefully, if we look at the data, we will decide whether it's something we can do to protect and help our citizens have a healthier life.
And before we would go any further, I would really like to get the input from the Department of Health. Dr. Hurlburt is online for questions, but we don't, again, I appreciate him being online, but we don't have really a lot of time to get into that now. But that question is on the table, if it's okay. If
sure.
It's Tuesday. Yeah.
Yep. That, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the length of time you've allowed for presenting this, because I think it could be very significant for the population of the state.
Just a clarification on page 6, line 9, Department of Health and Social Services to investigate substitute. Are you thinking of an administrative investigation there of what it would take to substitute vitamin D supplements for the flu vaccine? Are you talking about testing the use using, you know, controlled groups where you give some vitamin D and some the flu shot?
We could say study.
Okay.
If you prefer that rather than investigating. Yeah. But that's the idea. We're trying to stimulate them to take a look at it and take a look at the data on vaccines and see if we could do this and at least protect the population. And I get a vaccine as well as take vitamin D. I mean, both are beneficial. Vaccines are very specific on certain strains. Your own immune system is much broader and can work on many, many different upper respiratory diseases as well as specific strains. And hopefully there will be some other studies that they'll be able to look at as well as what we've found.
And back to the idea of providing, I think we're in new territory there, and I think you would agree. Where the government would provide vitamins, food supplements, I don't know that we're there now. And that kind of ties in with your first be it therefore resolved that we go to a prevention model.
Sure.
Right, yeah.
And of course, we do that for pregnant women now. I mean, we do prenatal vitamins and other things to make sure that we have healthy babies. In our, we look to make sure that we have folic acid and those things so we don't have neural tube disorders. And so that, but I'm sure willing to discuss further with you any.
Okay. Yeah, great. And just like I say, I wanted to get on the record, because I was thinking as I was reading this, there's a lot of studies that support vitamin C, vitamin E, so we could get into a, quite a laundry list if we start down this route, it's a lot. Anyway, thank you so much for your helpful presentation. Is there more questions from Representative Dick? I'm sorry.
Just a comment. I heard about the traditional diet and lack of vitamin D, and it wasn't about maybe about 30, 35 years ago we became aware that of the hydatid cyst in the that cycles between the moose and the dogs and the humans and whatnot. And that's about the point where we backed off from eating the organs. Mm. And I think that's where the diet started to fall away, because it's mostly in the liver, and that I think liver is pretty rich in vitamin D, and that used to be a very much a part of our diet. But once we learned about that hydatid cyst, and I don't know whether that came to Alaska, 35 years ago, or we just became aware. But once we became aware of that, we did start backing off from organ meats. And I think that's what we broke down on. The traditional diet isn't what it is now than what it used to be.
We have one person online. If you want to stay right there, it'd be fine. And if there's anything that comes up that you want to answer. Mary Mundell, is it, from Osceola? From home?
Yeah.
Oh, you're here. That's what I thought. I said, you sure she's online? She was up in my office today. Come on up. I actually had talked myself into the fact that it must be another Mary. Uh-huh. Well, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Mary Mundell, and I'm a pharmacist from Wasilla. I'm also a member of the State Board of Pharmacy. And what I wanted to let you know is that the prescription version, the vitamin D2, available only by prescription, has never been covered by the federal government. The Medicare Part D refuses to cover it. They consider it a nutrient. And the state of Alaska Medicaid, starting sometime in April or May, will no longer cover it. without a prior authorization approval through the physician's process, and the physician has to prove that the patient has failed on other vitamin Ds. Well, it's kind of a strange thing to do when there is no other vitamin D2 available except by prescription. So we don't know where that's going to lead, but we just thought that we'd let you know that most likely, because you want in your resolution for it, the legislature to encourage the Department of Health and Social Services to provide increased attention to vitamin D deficiency and promote awareness, it might be a good idea that perhaps maybe they cover the drug. So I just thought I would let you know. Thank you so much
for your testimony. Before we close, Dr. Herbert, our chief medical officer, is online. And I don't know if you've heard the whole discussion today or not, Dr. Herbert, but are there other things that we should be considering? If you have heard, we're considering some changes. Do you have anything you'd like to add to enlighten us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I did sign up just for questions, but actually did receive word since we started, and I have been online right from the beginning of the hearing here. And the administration's official position on this is neutral. I have to be terribly impressed, as all you were, with the homework and the diligence that Representative Seaton has engaged in this, reflecting his concern for the health of our fellow Alaskans. We have certainly appreciated his commitment and concern about preventive medicine, and share his concern about the loss of funding that we've had from the federal government to pay for the influenza vaccines for the adults there that we've had. I would like to express some concerns about this. As a generic issue, I'm concerned that the legislature is not a good place to make clinical decisions. And there have been times in the past when there's been great enthusiasm, including on the part of many medical scientists, for certain therapies and certain state legislatures, and then fortunately, we have avoided that in Alaska almost entirely. But some state legislatures have adopted mandates for therapy which were later shown to be not appropriate, and in fact at times resulted in large numbers of unnecessary premature deaths, for example, with the high-dose radiation and the bone marrow transplantation for women with metastatic breast cancer. So that's a concern that I would have. In my own career, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, that there have been times of great enthusiasm for other vitamins, such as vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin B12, and subsequently the enthusiasm waned as the benefits were really found to be narrower than were claimed. Certainly there is no disagreement that vitamin D is essential and is necessary and beneficial for bone disease. It prevents falls and so on. The National Institutes of Health contracted with the Institute of Medicine, which is the highly esteemed national group that looks at healthcare areas, and they did the kinds of literature review that Representative Seaton talked about. Basically, their conclusion was that the literature does support a conclusion that vitamin D is necessary for bone-related conditions like rickets, osteomalacia, and so on, likely effective for osteoporosis, which is weak bones, likely effective for preventing falls in older people. But for the other long, long list of conditions that Representative Seaton described, the Institute of Medicine categorized their findings from possibly effective to possibly ineffective to insufficient evidence. Their recommendations for vitamin D were at a lower level. There's agreement that toxicity at the 30,000 international unit level is a concern by both those who are more enthusiastic and those that are a little more cautious. But the Institute of Medicine states that daily amounts below 2,000 units are probably appropriate, and above that, possibly unsafe. For pregnant and lactating women, they state that higher doses in the 2000 may cause serious harm to an infant, and they use the word may. So my caution is that my own bias would be that I would hope we would not make clinical decisions in the legislature. I believe that there is a difference of opinion on the broad scope of benefits that Representative Seaton has done such an impressive job of researching and preventing there, but recognizing that there are scientists, as articulated by the Institute of Medicine, that do not come to the same conclusion. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Dr. Hurlburt, I really appreciate your testimony, and I would ask if you would to look at the resolution. We have time, between now. We won't hear it again until next Tuesday. And if you see something that implies or gets close to a clinical prescription decision, we would welcome it. And I see the sponsor shaking his head yes on that. So do you have a comment?
Thank you, and I appreciate that. And of course, what this resolution is doing is not mandating anything, but what it is doing is trying to put the onus on the Department of Health and Social Services to investigate and to follow up and to do the research and the literature research by Alaskans to look at this instead of looking at others and to see whether it's appropriate for us to go ahead. And if it is, then we should be protecting Alaskans. And my hope is that we will pass this and put it in your lap, and by next session we will have some answers so that we can work towards some minimal funding to actually improve the health of Alaskans. So that's the hope. No mandate here at all, but hopefully we will stimulate the conversation in the medical community of Alaska. Thank you.
One more question or comment here, Dr. Hurlburt, and then you can answer what you choose or not. It's up to you,
Representative Miller. This is Representative Miller. I actually hope this is a real yes-no, pretty easy question. Doctor, in your experience, have you ever personally seen or have you become aware of any study wherein a toxic level of any vitamin has ever presented itself in a fatal dosage? I've been watching for this for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, and I have not heard of one as yet. Have you?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, yes, I have. And very specifically with vitamin D, and there's full agreement on that. An interesting anecdote, there were some Arctic explorers a number of years ago, as Representative Dick talked about, who ate raw polar bear liver going toward the Arctic and died, and then it was found that's what they died from. Right. But those are from very, very high levels, much higher than we're talking about here, much higher than Representative Seaton's talking about.
I did read that same study, and I have to admit the one that I read indicated it was vitamin A, but I'm assuming maybe both vitamins live in the same liver.
Through the chair, I believe that's correct. Yes, Dr. Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hurlburt. Do you have anything else? Otherwise, we're going to gavel out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I do not.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us, and thank you for the interesting time gaveling out at 5 minutes.